July 26th is actually the 36th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. National data shows one in four people in our country has some kind of disability or impairment that can impact their everyday lives, which obviously includes in the workplace. So I wanted to acknowledge the ADA anniversary, but also talk about the legalities surrounding it. Joining us back on the show is Gary Phelan, who's an employment attorney at Hurwitz, Sagarin, and Slossberg right here in Milford, also a law professor at Quinnipiac University. And not to steal your thunder, Gary, I also think you are very qualified to talk about this. Didn't you co-author, something regarding disability discrimination in the workplace?
Oh, yes. Co-authored a legal treatise, basically a book called Disability Discrimination in the Workplace.
Okay, so I think you're the perfect person to discuss this. And welcome back to the show. How are you?
Good, Melissa. How are you? And happy birthday. It looks like two major events happened 36 years ago this week, as I understand it.
Yeah, I didn't realize I share a birthday week with the ADA. That's pretty cool. I didn't realize that. And I couldn't understand why you were asking. You're like, you're 36. And I thought, yes, I am. Why? And then I realized that it also turns 36 this week. So I don't know. 1990 must have been a very special year, apparently. Let's talk about when an impairment of some kind rise to the level of what is legally considered a disability. Gary, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, the statute says it has to be a substantial limitation of a major life activity. Now, easy examples, something like seeing, hearing, speaking, breathing, major life activities that would have to be affected by it. And substantial really depends on the degree in which it interferes with those activities. For example, you could have, let's say, multiple sclerosis. There may be somebody who really it has no effect on them, whereas another individual, it may be they're unable to walk, or it has other, substantial impact on their day-to-day life. So you have to really look at what the condition, the effect it has on the individual.
Hmm.
A couple of other things. One is that you look at the person like without the use of a mitigating measure. For example, let's say somebody with diabetes who takes insulin. The fact that it's under control when they take insulin doesn't mean they don't have a disability, because you look at them without the use. What would be their condition if they did not use insulin, which, frankly, it'd be a life-threatening condition.
But that actually leads me to a question, though, Gary, because when you bring up, for example, diabetes, I mean, that's something that a lot of people probably don't even realize the person in the cubicle next to them may have it. When should a person disclose a disability to the employer?
I've always followed the general rule in advising clients that unless there's a need to disclose, don't disclose. You never know the impact it may have on the workplace. The general reason why there would be a need to disclose is when the person is seeking a reasonable accommodation of some kind relating to the impairment. Now, I'm finding that as disabilities become more of the, relatively common types of things that people talk about, that it's more of a, and I think ADA is largely a catalyst for that, where discussions related to disability are more out in the open, both physical and mental impairments, that isn't, if you were asking me the question 20 years ago, I'd be saying, absolutely, don't disclose, unless there's a need to do so.
Mm.
But I've had clients say, this is who I am. This is a part of my life, and I'm not going to try to hide it or disclose it. But so it really depends on the individual. But generally speaking, unless there's a need to disclose, I always advise erring on the side of caution and not disclosing.
Right. Well, because to your point, Gary, is there a chance that if you are discriminated against, you could answer that better. Is it very challenging to prove that your disability is the reason that you're being... So, for example, I'm going to throw something out there, okay? And my brother no longer works there, but he worked at a incredibly popular theme park in America. That's how I'm going to put it. And he worked at the golf courses there. And for years, he wanted to make more money, obviously. And you can only make so much money in certain sectors of the golf course. But where you really can make the money is at the clubhouse. If you work in the shop, the pro shop. And he worked at this establishment for almost a decade and was never even offered to be trained in the pro shop. And we never could prove it. But no matter how much seniority my brother had, no matter how hard he worked, all of that, it was very hard to overlook if his autism had anything to do with it, because he did disclose to his employers that he was autistic. And I don't know. And I'm wondering, from your standpoint, do you feel that it is challenging, especially if it is either an impairment, a disability, you know, a challenge, whatever you want to call it? Is it hard to prove that that's the reason that you have not been offered that raise or offered to even look at a different job in that same company, what have you? Like, is that challenging to do, especially if it's kind of one of those invisible ones, like a diabetes, like a, you know, an autism, even Asperger? I don't know.
That's a very good question. Using that as an example, what I want to look at is, were other individuals who were hired, like, in similar career paths, were they promoted?
Yes.
Was there a request for accommodation? Did the person say, you know, I'd like to get promoted? What did the employer respond if they didn't get promoted? What were the performance reviews in the past? For example, let's say he had outstanding performance evaluations, but then doesn't get promoted. And you look at other individuals and they were promoted. Those would be the sorts of things that might be evidence of that perceptions relating to disabilities was the reason they weren't promoted. That said, going back to your original question, yes, it can be difficult. Often, for example, where there's a new, let's say a person's just diagnosed with cancer. They've had 5 years of outstanding reviews. All of a sudden, 3 months after they're diagnosed, they get a bad review. Those are the kinds of indications that raise questions about whether or not there's some sort of disability discrimination. So each, you know, the even compared to other employment areas of employment law, I think ADA is more complex. It's more challenging. But at the same time, I think, you know, this is in so many ways one of the most important civil rights laws in our history.
We are chatting with Gary Fallon, who is an employment attorney with Hurwitz, Sagarin and Slossberg here in Milford, but also a law professor at Quinnipiac University. And we're talking about the 36th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act, signed on July 26th, which is pretty amazing. You're so right, Gary. I tell you, all good things happen in 1990, specifically July of 1990. I had no idea that I shared a birthday week with the ADA, which is pretty cool. And as you know, even if you were listening to the segment earlier, the ADA is something that is very near and dear to my heart, the Sheketoff family heart, because my brother is on the autism spectrum, very high functioning, is really a modern marvel, quite frankly. He is truly my hero. I don't know. I could go on and on and start crying about my brother. He's amazing. But the ADA is something that matters a lot to us and so many other families across America when you talk about advocating for people who have impairments or disabilities or just different challenges than, you know, the people around them. And that certainly carries through into the workplace. You know, so we were talking before about when and if a person should disclose a disability to their employer. How do you request or negotiate reasonable accommodations? And again, it's varying, right? I mean, I think it's a little bit easier, if you will, to justify if you have somebody who is, you know, wheelchair bound, but, you know, otherwise that's what you're accommodating to, versus if it's somebody who maybe neurologically needs some accommodations made. So I wanted to get your take on that.
Reasonable accommodation is really the linchpin of the ADA. What makes it unique from so many other laws, which in the workplace is more focused on what you can't do. This is saying what the employer needs to do. When counseling individuals, what I say is basically is to provide, you know, let the employer know what the impairment is, then and make say this is what I need. ideally to have it supported by a letter from a healthcare provider, both with respect to the, you know, the diagnosis as well as the requested accommodation. But the manner in which the request is made is as important as what you're requesting. So it's not, you know, I have sometimes clients who come to me after the accommodation wasn't made where they basically said, do this or, you know, my doctor took me out of work. I remind them, your doctor doesn't sign your paycheck. To not just tell them this is what you need to do, but it's a two-way discussion. It is, as you said, a negotiation. So to ask after you disclose the impairment, first also put in where I generally advise clients to do it in writing, but to say, please keep this information confidential. Even though it's required under the law, it's a good way to remind them of that. And end the, you know, the written letter by saying, if you'd like to speak to my healthcare provider, you know, feel free to do so. If you want to meet, if you want to talk further, let me know, because the employer can also offer an alternative accommodation. Maybe they think that accommodation, you know, is too expensive or it's not going to work, but what about this other alternative? There really has to be a two-way street. And that's where the reasonable accommodation works, where it's done together with the employer.
It's amazing, really. Again, and nothing is perfect, right, Gary? I think you and I can agree that the ADA does an awful lot, you know, protecting against discrimination, improving accessibility, requiring accommodations if needed, promoting kind of equal opportunity, even kind of changing people's attitudes about hiring those who have impairments or disabilities, right? I mean, so there's a lot that comes out of 36 years of having the ADA, which again was signed into law in July of 1990. But I think we can also agree that there are a lot of challenges that remain, a lot of obstacles that still are there. What would you say, though, also stands out about the ADA? I mean, the fact is if you go back to when this did become law, it had a lot of strong bipartisan support. And I know sometimes we'll throw that around because it's like, yeah, well, it's better to vote for it than against it. But there was actual bipartisan support around the ADA, and it just was kind of logical. There were no real politics around this. It was, you know, hey, people are capable despite how they look, how they sound, if they have things going on, and we need to give them equal opportunity, right? I mean, talk about the significance of the ADA and how it still prevails, you know, more than three decades later.
The ADA is really a hallmark of bipartisan government action that benefits all, because it was a, you know, one of the things about civil rights legislation, it's often just assumed it's generally something that's pushed by Democrats or civil rights groups. This was unique because it was actually George Bush, the first one, Bush 41. When in the 1988 presidential campaign, he reached out to the disability community and said, if I become president, there will be an Americans with Disabilities Act. Now, part of the reason for that is what you just mentioned, Melissa, about your family, is there were people in his family that were disabled. So he had awareness of it. And that's one of the things I think that's made ADA unique, is that, you know, there's no, you know, disability doesn't choose between parties. It affects families. It affects individuals. And so it was something where some of the biggest supporters of the Americans with Disabilities Act were people who were Republican, like Bob Dole, who's, you know, had war injuries. But it was a very complicated kind of civil rights legislation. It wasn't just employment. It was public accommodations. But part of the rationale, for example, in the workplace was people with disabilities want to work. They don't want to just get sort of government handouts. And so if you can save the government money while simultaneously providing the opportunity to work, it's, you know, the classic win-win situation of what negotiations try to always accomplish. So I think it was, you know, but it's unfortunate that now, you know, something that passed overwhelmingly, you know, now in this area of you know, kind of bipartisan bickering, I don't know if it would even pass because of the, you know, whatever one side thinks is a good idea. It's, you know, it's a principle in negotiation called reactive devaluation. If one side thinks it's good, the other side said, well, it can't be good for me. This was truly something that was good and beneficial for everyone. And I think that that is, you know, I'm still hopeful that at someday we can return to the environment that produced something like the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Yeah, and you know, to your point earlier, Gary, it's certainly not perfect. There are still kind of gaps in it, and I know at least here in Connecticut, there's a real effort to try and be more accommodating, try and make sure that with messaging, we know it's equal opportunity. We actually do follow through and give equal opportunity at workplaces, small, large, everything in between. So I you know, we always can continue, you know, doing better and improving on systems in place. But again, can't ignore the fact that the ADA being signed into law in July of 1990 was not a significant move for the country. And it's amazing, already turning 36 this upcoming weekend, July 26th. And Gary Phelan, I want to thank you for what you do professionally. Again, employment attorney with Hurwitz, Sagrin and Schlossberg here in Milford, law professor at Quinnipiac University, and somebody who also has worked very closely. I know this is a topic that's near and dear to your heart as well. And I appreciate you talking about it here on the show. Thank you so much.